Trump sneeringly calls them mobs, but that is what democracy looks like. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The unjust powers that be can only maintain their power when we accept and believe what they tell us, that we are powerless. They insist we accept that there's nothing we can do. That is not the truth. We are anything but powerless. In recent days, some 200,000 people filled the streets of Minsk, the capital of Belarus. Called Europe's last dictator, Alexander Lukashenko is facing renewed waves of pressure from the massive protests. Lukashenko has held the reins of power for 26 years, and a recent election was seen as highly dubious. The point is, crowds matter. A lot. The political power of crowds is demonstrated throughout history. Demands for racial justice have appeared in large and loud street protests across America in the wake of the gruesome killing of George Floyd. And as it always does, the attention has shifted somewhat to other media-grabbing headlines. So what, if anything, was accomplished? This is a good time to look at the history of crowds. Are they effective? What works and what doesn't? Do average people really have power to force change? With us today is Peter N. Stearns, professor of history at George Mason University. Peter Stearns, thanks for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
My pleasure. Interesting topic.
Oh, indeed it is. Peter Stearns served as American Historical Association Vice President for Teaching, and he's written widely in world and social history with a recent book on time in world history. He also teaches undergraduates in both areas. Long active in the field of history of emotion, he is currently working on a book, Happiness in World History. His latest book, co-authored with Marcus Collins, is Why Study History? I was intrigued by his article on the History News Network titled, Let's Return Historical Attention to the Crowd. And that's what we're going to talk about. Stearns writes in that article, one angle that has not received due attention involves what history tells us about crowd behavior and how this in turn might provide useful perspectives on current tensions. We Americans, of course, rarely, if ever, learn from history, but I'm not about to give up. So that's what we're here to talk about. Well, you probably are familiar with the story about Franklin Roosevelt. Upon meeting with A. Philip Randolph, who was head of the all-black Pullman Porters Union. Roosevelt, the president, said to Mr. Randolph, you know, Mr. Randolph, I've heard everything you've said tonight, and I couldn't agree with you more. I agree with everything that you've said, including my capacity to be able to right many of these wrongs and to use my power and the bully pulpit. But I want to ask one thing of you, Mr. Randolph, and that is to go out and make me do it. What did he mean by that?
Well, obviously, he's talking about the potential force of various kinds of group action, assemblies, petitions, to prod action, which leaders in some cases would like to take, but hesitate because of countervailing forces. So he's basically saying, need a push.
Need a push, and we can do that, really. Another applicable quote for which I don't know the source is, politics and protest, both necessary, neither sufficient. Voting is important, running for office is important. How are political expressions of crowds important as additional channels for making change?
Well, they're really sort of two situations, and you've suggested elements of both of them. The most classic situation for crowd action occurs in societies that don't have an effective vote at all, as is the case in Belarus, apparently. There and historically, this was of crucial importance in a whole range of societies. There, crowd action can call attention to popular anger, popular grievance, in ways that often don't exist in any other channels. So that's the classic case, where you need crowd action to put pressure on government because there's no systematic mechanism for expression of wider opinion. The more interesting situation, the one that's more relevant for us, is a situation where voting does exist, but it is either ineffective or has lagged behind events or is failing to represent some key group. And crowd action in this case simply pushes the government, as Roosevelt was suggesting with Mr. Randolph, pushes the government to do things that it is otherwise either unwilling or hesitant to do. So crowd action here is in addition to other means of political expression, and it's an interesting balance.
Yeah, interesting. People who participate in crowds get and protest get angry that, like, what is it going to take? What is it going to take? I remember back in the late 60s, the protests against the war in Vietnam got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and the war kept going on. And it was really, really frustrating. But eventually, I do believe it did work. The president, Johnson, didn't run for re-election. Nixon lied a little bit, saying that he was going to end the war quickly. But it did matter. And yeah, it's frustrating. People in America, I think especially, like instant solutions. I want it right now. Well, history rarely works that way. There's been harsh resistance to democracy and a Republican form of government, not just by Trump, but by monarchies and dictators, at least since the revolutions in Europe of 1848. If there's a king, a czar, a dictator, they own power. They didn't have the right to vote, particularly back then. They were just trying to create a Republican form of government. Why did a crowd matter in those cases?
Okay, well, there are at least two related scenarios. One is you have a government that is open to possibility of change, but hesitant. The assembling of a large crowd can be the nudge that pushes it to some degree of action. It's not because the crowd is out of control, but simply represents a body of opinion that is sufficiently menacing that the government thinks it needs to make some concessions. The more classic case, and this is obviously the current situation in Minsk, the more classic case is the crowd really wants the government, or at least the leader of the government, to step down in favor of somebody else. And the crowd pressure there needs to be combined with a leadership that's deeply frightened and or a military and police force that is unreliable. If the military stands its ground, and this will be true in Belarus, if the military stands its ground, certainly in a 20th or 21st century situation, given the weaponry available, it's not going to be dislodged by a crowd. So depends on the size, vigor, intelligence of the crowd, but we also have to recognize that a great deal depends on the nature of the response.
Yeah, we've seen that quite a bit. Makes me think about 1989 in Tiananmen Square, when the crowd was demanding one thing and the military did something else. They stopped it. So there's
They won.
And it's not just that they won the battle. It seems that they kind of won the war for a long time. But then I think of Hong Kong right now. You know, there's tremendous crowds out there. And I have a good friend, actually, my first cousin, who lived in Hong Kong for a long time. And he's very, very frightened of what Beijing will probably do. There's huge crowds there. The people are still gathering in crowds in Hong Kong. But it does make it more difficult for the central government in Beijing to crack down. does it not? I mean, there have been lots of instances where they just attack their own people.
Yeah. And then the, you know, again, we have classic historical situations. The question then is, in some cases, you have an initial police or military crackdown, and it looks like it will be successful.
Right.
But violence involved, the repression involved, raises a wider public alarm. This seems to be the case currently in Belarus, for example. The initial crowds were put down, apparently a number of people arrested, reports of widespread torture, and this has galvanized bigger crowds. And again, the situation is yet to be determined. But this is a series of waves over time with crowd response, and then does the crowd resume? Does it return? Does it become more menacing?
Yeah, interesting. And there is, of course, the role of it used to be called the press, now it's the media. And I'm thinking back again to Chicago 68, when the chant was, the whole world is watching, the whole world is watching. And I can't help but think that the politicians in power care about such things, at least to some extent, because it might affect their power. I mean, I suppose they can just say, I don't care. But I would
think...
Well,
I mean...
Go ahead.
The Chinese, for example, in 89, the Chinese didn't care.
Clearly not. But it was secretive. We still don't know how many people were killed. It was a few hundred, a few thousand. Somehow we were kept in the dark about that. And shedding light on things, I think, I'm guessing here, is one of the ways that crowds can have actual effect, is demanding attention, as you say, and drawing light on what's really going on. And it's hard to ignore a really big crowd. And
right.
In your article, there's a photograph, which is, this is radio, so I can't show it here, but there's one photograph, and there's a bunch of different crowds that sometimes have spontaneously arisen and made history. And I think, of course, of the Astor Place riot of 1849, pictured in your article. There's also, I'll give you a few, and then you can, you know, just tell us about them in general. The draft riots of New York City in 1863, and then the unplanned massive crowds led by angry, starving women spontaneously in St. Petersburg in 1905, which sparked the revolution. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about these, please, and how effective they were at making the change desired. Was it the surprising crowd size that moved history? Was the violence only counterproductive? There's a lot there, so I'll let you go, Professor.
The obvious point is there's simply no formula. This apparently disorganized crowds, though we need to come back to the disorganized claim, apparently disorganized crowds can have a profound effect if they tap a larger vein of public opinion, if they shake the military or police forces.
Mm.
Remember, police forces are ordinary people, and they can respond in various ways to the crowd actions of ordinary people. They can be repressive. They're trained to be repressive. And I think that training has become more systematic in recent decades.
Yeah.
But they can also be widely sympathetic. I think, for example, we don't know. It was very interesting that the federal deployment in Portland recently carefully avoided the use of the military. There's several reasons for that. But they were relying on special forces that are less likely to be, to have a sense of community with the crowds involved.
Mm.
So there's simply no single scenario, which is one of the tantalizing aspects of crowd history. But there are some basic points. You started with one, that crowds can be immensely effective, either immediately or at least over a term. Crowds are usually, and this is one of the key things we know from previous historical work, crowds are usually fairly purposeful. They have goals. They're not just random. They're not usually randomly violent. So we know some things about crowds, but we can't predict exactly how effective a crowd will be in a particular situation. There are too many variables.
Of course, though, the draft riots of New York City in 1863, my understanding of that is, and I am just an amateur history buff, is that there was the draft for the war against Southern secession, and if wealthy people could pay $300, they could be exempt from the war. That got, you know, from the draft, and that got some people not really pleased. I wonder how, and the military did fire on them. I'm actually not quite sure what any results may have been from the draft riots. Do you know?
Well, the procedure was eased. The pressure on the draft was eased. It didn't have a systematic result, but it certainly certainly led to some greater caution in both the and the exemptions.
That's a good thing. And I was, it's interesting to me how many uprisings have been spontaneous, including the women, the angry, starving women in St. Petersburg in 1905. It was not planned. It's just they were angry. They were literally starving. And of course, had the Tsar made some concessions, he might have avoided the revolution of 1917. But whatever, that's what happened. Now, there was another crowd that I participated in, about 500,000 of us at the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair, summer of 69. It seems conservatives came to assume that there was a political and cultural message in this crowd. I don't think that's accurate, but how do you think fear of counterculture crowds by the right, of that kind of, there was a lot of fear on the right of the naked tripping hippies, whatever they called it. How do you think that affected their longer term political agenda? I think it had more effect than people might realize, even though I think it was largely incorrect because there was no actual message there, just, you know, rock and roll. Go ahead.
No. I think your statement is correct. I'm not sure it's just Woodstock. It obviously linked to other manifestations of hippie behavior. So I do think there's pretty good evidence that the manifestations of the so-called counterculture in the 60s created the beginnings of a culture chasm that we're still dealing with a growing separation between conservative critics of what they see as tendencies toward greater moral laxity and people who are more comfortable with at least some of those manifestations.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were, frankly, afraid of that. And fear is, you know, one of the most powerful things in history that leads people around. Oops, I just came unplugged here. Sorry, I have, You still there?
Yeah.
I just came unplugged for a minute. I have a new wire thing my kid said was better, but I'm not so sure. Let's see. So I'm of the opinion that fear of, you know, the unknown, people having different cultural and moral values helped really create the right wing. You know, they call themselves cultural conservatives, but I don't think they're really conserving anything. But you know, there's thesis, antithesis. These things work through history, and I think the crowd there sparked a very strong reaction that we're still feeling. I mean, Pat Buchanan at the 1992 Republican convention talking about a culture war. It's still going on, and I think we're going to see more of it at the Republican National Convention. They worship their guns, and anyway, that's sort of separate. But for those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and our guest today is Peter Stearns, professor of history at George Mason University. We're talking about an article he wrote on History News Network called Let's Return Historical Attention to the Crowd. We're talking about crowds and the power of crowds to do many different things. When I was growing up, there was that term mob psychology. It was something to be most wary of. Watch out for mob psychology. It was cited as a partial explanation for the rise of Hitler with his massive rallies. I learned that somehow the united loud voice of the crowd overtakes each individual's more rational judgment capability. Your thoughts on this, please, mob psychology.
Okay. So there are two or three things to say here. One of the reasons, let me go back to the history part first of all. One of the reasons that historians got deeply interested in crowds in the 50s and 60s involved, obviously, the fact that crowds were assembling at that point. You've referred to some of them in terms of anti-war protests, et cetera. There were also the range of student protests in Europe and elsewhere. But historians at that point were deeply concerned with making it clear that mob psychology is probably a misleading term that's manipulable for several reasons. Their argument was that crowds are usually more carefully disciplined. They're not random. Let me give you a specific example. Now, there are counterexamples to this. Most crowds don't primarily attack people. There are exceptions, including race riot crowds. But most crowds leave personal security pretty much alone unless they're provoked by the police. They're not so careful with regard to property. But the point here is crowds are not indiscriminate. So the notion that you have a mob seized by passion, unrestrained, attacking anything they can attack, that is not usually true. I don't mean it's never true, but it's not usually true. Now, Hitler's crowds, I think, were a different animal. These were not, for the most part, spontaneous crowds.
Mm.
They were manipulated by leadership, carefully marshaled by the what became the forerunners of the SS,
right.
Hitler's armed thugs. I don't mean these aren't crowds to be considered in the crowd phenomenon, but they're actually not typical. They're important, but not typical. So the key point here is mob psychology is probably a misleading concept, and it's a concept that really has to be grappled with because the common conservative response to crowds, and again, it's not totally wrong, it's not totally misunderstood, it's not totally off the mark, but the standard conservative response to crowds, and we've seen it with the racial protest crowds of recent weeks.
Right.
Standard conservative response is these are anarchists, right. They're nutcases, they're out of control, therefore anything we do to restore order is okay. Most historians would argue that's an understandable but definite misreading of the way crowds behave and the importance of taking their concerns more seriously and not just dismissing them as rabble.
Interesting. Yeah, you can see that. And you know, again, fear is just a manipulation of fear, as it often works. And if people can be afraid, Trump had advertisements showing the violence in the streets of Portland there, like, you know, we have to have law and order. And of course, you know, it reminds me, Nixon. He did very, very well with that in 1968. Raised the level of fear and said law and order, and it worked really well. And it seems like Trump is trying to do that. I don't know if it's going to work. You know, there's the majority and the minority, and they're shifting all the time. Crowds get smaller, they get bigger. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think your scenario is correct. The evidence so far is that, A, most of the crowds in the recent round of popular protests, most of them have been quite well behaved.
Yes.
So that obviously weakens the conservative argument that this is simply a set of uncontrollable threats to public order. A good bit, I don't mean that this is entirely true,
mm-hmm.
but a good bit of the violence or excessive destruction that has occurred has been in response to police provocation mm. rather than his crowd action. So far, this has been a fairly disciplined set of crowd behaviors. And so far, it has not alienated wide swaths of public opinion. Whether it will be effective, we haven't talked about effectiveness yet, but whether it will be effective is another question. But so far, it's not playing into a wide conservative or repressive trope about the need for restoration of order, support Trump because of imminent chaos, et cetera.
Mm.
This could So far, that's been the case.
Well, there have been all these right-wing efforts to really criminalize protest in the United States. And gosh, Putin did that a while ago. And there have been suggestions that Trump listens to Putin. I can't imagine. But they behave as though all First Amendment assembly and protest is already criminal, to be met with sadistic brutality, setting us up for a conflagration. This was somebody who wrote this. That quote was from somebody on Facebook. And there's a professor, Skylar Forster, who teaches political science at Colorado College. He wrote of the images projected on our screens, quote, "These protests have been mostly peaceful, as you point out. At their outset, however, our media showed images of burning cities, vandalism, looting, and protesters throwing objects at the police. To the extent that people perceived protests as uncontrolled acts of violence by radical groups intent on fomenting anarchy, the protests were phenomena to be contained and controlled by the application of dominant force." End of quote there. And of course, Trump is all about dominance. That's the only thing he values. Again, these protests have been mostly peaceful, but the media loves drama, you know, action. If there's no action, they're not going to show it, you know, and they like to see burning things and smashing things. And somehow some young men, I think mostly young white men, have kind of gotten in there and thought, oh, this will be fun. Let's play Batman in the streets and just smash things. And they fall for it. It was interesting. Just yesterday, I received an email from the Trump campaign. How I'm on that list, I don't know. But referring to the Democratic ticket, Biden and Harris as corrupt career politicians who love anarchy and hate America, love and hate being in capital letters. That's amazing to me that he could say that. Your article reflects this in what you say is the common conservative argument that crowds, mobs, are simply violently irrational and that as a result, their demand do not warrant serious consideration. I would think this Trump-Pence argument has some power and potential to resonate with a lot of Americans. I mean, fear of mob violence was a big factor, as I mentioned, in Nixon in 68. More thoughts on this, please.
Well, again, it's a fairly standard scenario. The forces of order, so-called, the conservative groups, almost always try to portray crowds as out of control, almost always try to exaggerate the violence, and the question is, you know, how restrained the crowds will be despite provocation, how larger public opinion will react, and whether the forces of order will continue to be willing to operate in a repressive manner. In the United States, as you well know, much of the responsibility is local, and a good many of the local situations have been handled with considerable
decency.
Exactly. And for the most part, they've, for example, in my own city, near where I live, Washington, D.C., aside from that round of federal action associated with Trump's famous press conference, they've been fairly restrained, and the crowds have been, again, with some exceptions, crowds have been pretty restrained, too. One other thing to remember in terms of the historical lesson, some of the crowds we look back on as having been deeply successful, for example, the crowds in Boston associated with the preliminary stages of what led to the American Revolution, even crowds that we look back on as they had good purposes, they had good results, these crowds did some property damage too. Crowds are, again, my argument would be crowds are usually fairly disciplined. They have goals. They're not irrational. But they do spill over. They have anger, and the anger needs some outlet, and that's going to lead to a certain degree of messiness, even in crowds that, in retrospect, we look back as forerunners of our republic.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, the idea of, this may be stretching things a little bit, I don't know, the idea of a nation, you know, when people get together and they have similar points of view, and, for example, you know, in 1774, I think it was, with the Boston Tea Party and the various protests there, that was a new nation being formed. But so, you know, people that stick together, feel some affinity with one another. You know, the lines that are drawn on the map, I don't think necessarily delineate the various different nations. Witness the old Ottoman Empire and many places like that. Anyway, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Peter Stearns, professor of history at George Mason University, discussing his article, Let's Return Historical Attention to the Crowd. And people do get angry. People are angry. There's a lot to be angry at. You know, the killing of George Floyd was an outrage, of course. People are justifiably angry. I've seen some posts on Facebook saying, burn it down. People went to Portland, mostly young white males, looking for the fun of street action. As you note, the press pays primary attention to occasional instances of property damage. Violence has been an occasional factor in making political change, has it not? I mean, there have been various Lenin, I think it was, and Mao, perhaps sort of glorified violence, saying it has to be done. The so-called riots of 1967, and after the Rodney King verdict, there was some violence. My old political science professor, who passed away a long time ago, defined politics as the economy of violence. And I think that's accurate. Wars are just a little violent and are at their root political. What can be said to the angry young people who claim that, well, we have reason to be angry, and they say that nonviolence now is like Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler? What would you say to them?
Well, okay. I would say, frankly, violence is tricky.
Go ahead.
It's already. It can be deeply counterproductive when undue violence sparks a popular reaction that chaos threatens. It's likely to lead to levels of repression that are simply overwhelming. One of the reasons for nonviolence, I mean, there's a deep philosophical undercurrent in nonviolence,
yes.
But one of the reasons for the rise of nonviolent tactics and philosophies, Gandhi and Martin Luther King, is that by the 20th century, and certainly in the 21st, you can't usually beat the police. You just...
True.
As you could. The weapons gap between ordinary people and the forces of repression, the weapons gap was not always that great. But right now it's huge. So my basic response is, no matter how angry you are, you need to think of the repercussions of what you're doing if you want achievements other than a brief letting off of steam. And systematic violence is simply not going to work. It's going to draw down a combination of police repression and public revulsion.
Yes.
And the effort will be put down. Protests in the contemporary world that are more subtle, that are largely restrained, they can be successful. They have been successful. The protests, the civil rights protests of the 1960s, mm-hmm. they fell short of some of the big goals, which is why we're still in this mess.
Mm-hmm.
They did have some genuine effects. Buses were desegregated. The separate fountains, et cetera, were eliminated.
Yeah.
Blacks were able to sit at counters.
Yeah.
These are not as much as one would have hoped for, but they were real results. And they were the result of protest that was carefully nonviolent despite police provocation. And again, my basic response to the we must be violent at all costs is the only time violence will ultimately prevail is if you have a situation that is fundamentally revolutionary, that support for the current regime has been so exhausted that some violent acts will further public revulsion and the government can be toppled. I don't think in the contemporary United States we're in a revolutionary situation. You may wish we were, but I just don't think so. Because revolutionary situations mean that the government's going to give up, the repression will be called off, and you can have a replacement strategy. I don't think we're there.
No.
You can argue we're near civil war,
right.
But we're not near revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some, you know, I wish people would look at history when they call for revolution, burn it down. No, learn a little bit what works and what doesn't work. they want instant solutions. I don't know. And I do value scholarship, that is for sure. Your scholarship has uniquely examined the field of history of emotion. From your article, emotion, the most obviously anger, sometimes fear of or hope, is an essential element in binding a crowd together, motivating it to take risks and step out of the normal routine. As you say, emotion and rational action are not, after all, necessarily in conflict. Tell us more about that, please. Emotions and rational action.
Okay. As you've said, and it's pretty obvious, crowds are often angry, or they may be spurred by other emotions. Fear-based crowds are not unusual, and there's an element of fear in crowd protests against police brutality. But emotion in the crowd is important for two reasons, which you've already suggested. Reason one is it spurs people to get out of their routine in the first place. I mean, for some people, crowds can be sort of fun, particularly if you're young.
Yes.
But getting out in the streets means you're interrupting normal activities. You risk repression. You risk arrest. Sometimes you're sacrificing a day's paycheck. So you need something that motivates you to get there. And the emotion is often the something. And then the second feature, which you've also referred to, is the extent to which emotion can help make the crowd feel a sense of unity and power that goes beyond simply a collection of individuals. And that can be very inspiring. It can be an important part of the effectiveness of the crowd. It can help the crowd be sufficiently motivated to come back day after day, at least for a period of time. So I think admitting and analyzing the role of emotion in crowd action is both valid and important, and it does not push you over into the camp of saying, well, you're just talking about an irrational mob.
True. If you can keep the rationality in there, keep the eyes on the prize, as they say, you know, the two are not necessarily in conflict. And I guess that takes a little bit of coherence and people working together, which doesn't always happen in large groups, but it can. And
you know, often,
go ahead.
And we've seen this in the recent protests. Often, some spontaneous leadership does arise in
yes,
crowds.
Yes.
We've seen examples of spontaneous leaders stepping forward to restrain violence.
Yes.
And of course, there are other leadership elements in the organizations like Black Lives Matter. So this is not just a random bunch of people.
True. They know the term Black Lives Matter, very clear. And I do believe it's always important to have a message that's very few words and communicates what you want. And that certainly does it, Black Lives Matter. In recent crowd-related actions, as you write, immediate tangible targets, statues, and other physical symbols of injustice have been an important focus. These objects, they've been defaced, physically attacked, pulled down by crowds. My sense is that these objects were put there by the will of the crowds at the time. Is there some nexus, perhaps, between putting them up and taking them down?
Okay, well, let's see. Two comments. First of all, I find the attacks on statues fascinating. Go back to the crowd action in Boston before the American Revolution. One of the first acts of the crowd was to pull down a statue of the British governor. So this is an old crowd phenomenon, attacking symbols. During the French Revolution, the statue of every king in Paris except one was pulled down. So the symbolic aspect is important, and I think it's a function of the extent to which you have a crowd that's deeply emotional, that's really angry, and needs some quick, tangible results. Limitation, but it's also an important spur. So one of the tangible results is, let's take down these symbols. This is a way to get at least a sense of short-term satisfaction, and hopefully it will be part of a larger set of changes that needs to come about more gradually. So symbolic focus here is fascinating. in the case of the Confederate statues,
yes,
I don't think it's accurate to say it's one crowd replacing another. As you know, most of the Confederate statues were erected well after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
They were not the result of Civil War passion. They were fairly deliberately planned by groups like the Confederate women, fairly deliberately planned to create a mythology of the Confederacy, a mythology of Confederate heroism, and they certainly had popular support, but I don't think it was massive, spontaneous crowd action that caused these statues to be erected in the first place, as opposed to a more manipulative approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It was well thought out to honor these people. And changing myths, ooh, boy, that is hard. You know, America has had a lot of myths. We, you know, had Columbus discovered America. Nowadays, we see it as just white colonialism and horrible racism. And changing the symbols that are involved in myths, it's really interesting because these symbols communicate values like Columbus or Robert E. Lee. In this age of instant communications, other tangible things used by crowds can also communicate. And I think of, again, showing my age, the Yippies in Chicago, 68, nominating a pig for president. Symbol.
Right.
Direct communication. And more recently, the giant helium-filled baby, orange baby Donald Trump paraded at the protests. Dad didn't need to be any words to communicate the message. How valuable is the use of such objects in crowd protests, especially in this age of instant communication?
Oh, I think your point is quite valid. I mean, again, I think there's a fairly long-standing pattern here. The role of banners in crowds, red banners waved in European crowds in the 19th and early 20th century, representations are, I think, an important way that crowds express both their sense of purpose and their sense of unity.
Uh-huh. That's good. Purpose and unity. What a concept. It has some strength to it, that's for sure. And I wonder, you know, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, the huge crowds in Hong Kong, I wonder how much of a problem it is for Beijing. Maybe they don't feel like it is a problem. Maybe they feel like, what the heck, we're just going to crush them. Does the size of the crowds make it harder for the bad guys like those guys in Beijing to crush? What can Beijing do? Are they just going to do the old-fashioned thing and just squash them? I mean, who knows?
That's honestly my guess. Combination of squash them and outweigh them. I mean, one of the limitations of crowds is, and I think we're experiencing some of this in the United States, one of the limitations of crowds is they really can't show up day after day for long periods of time.
Yeah.
Remnants can, but most people just can't afford to do that.
Right.
They don't have the wherewithal, they don't have the emotional energy. So if you have a repressive regime that can keep the crowd at bay, that avoids too blatant provocation through undue violence or torture, and simply waits, your chances of winning, whether right or wrong, your chances of winning are pretty good. Remember one other thing, however. Crowds recur.
Ah.
That is, you can have a period of crowd action that doesn't work. And a few years pass, the basic problems are not resolved, and the crowds reassemble. So short-term frustration is not necessarily the same thing as long-term failure.
Yeah, that's sort of a hard lesson for people to learn, especially in this age of instant gratification. For sure. You know, you can lose the battle but win the war. We all know that.
Sometimes.
And again, Chicago, 1968, what eventually was declared a police riot. The federal secret police troops that invaded Portland using rather violent tactics. You write that the outright use of force by police is itself a variable affecting crowds' behavior. It seems that this violent invasion, I get the sense that it unleashed something new in protest, not just demanding radical change, But people in the middle, having an emotion of merely defending themselves in their city streets and neighborhoods from violence by the invading force. I think of the Wall of Moms in Portland, that they were, you know, there to try to protect other people, thinking the cops won't attack a wall of moms. Your thoughts on this new seeming sense of just defending ourselves. What do you think the chances are of this resonating and spreading, being a little bit different angle of crowd behavior affecting politics this unusual year, 2020?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me the big question now, and it's a question that's quite appropriate for this week with the Democratic Convention. The big question now is, will crowd action translate into political action, or is it, in the minds of some, a substitute for political action?
Oh, wow.
Because it's more fun, it's more immediate, you can get some symbolic victories fairly quickly, and I think this is the big question for right now. The people who've participated in these crowds are groups that historically have relatively low voting rates.
Yes.
They're antagonized from the political process. It's one of the reasons they're in the crowd in the first place. So in terms of results from this round of protest, and again, I'm biased by my own political hopes.
Oh, that's okay.
I think the crucial question is the extent to which crowd action can be supplemented by other behaviors in a democracy. Because the fundamental goals of these crowds, for example, police reform, are not overnight accomplishments.
Right.
And they're complicated. They're not as neat as desegregating a bus, for example. So I think one of the things to look at in crowd behavior in democracies is the extent to which crowd action can be combined with other kinds of behaviors, combined result of which is effectiveness.
That's an interesting point. As was said earlier, politics and protest, both necessary, neither sufficient. Got to be combined to make some real change. For those who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about returning historical attention to the crowd. Our guest today is Peter Stearns, professor of history at George Mason University. And Trump certainly is aware of crowds. He focuses relentlessly on ratings, approval by large crowds. His rallies, for example, he makes stuff up about the size of his inauguration crowd. I guess in terms of crowds, size does matter. What do you think is the effect on the right wing of crowd size? I mean, Trump makes it really important. He's had these rallies, and the one in Tulsa wasn't nearly as big as he had hoped. How important is, I mean, we know how important it is to the left, but how important do you think it is on the right wing of crowd size? And they're going to have their convention very soon as well.
Sure. Well, I mean, Trump obviously is a terrific showman. And I think during the previous presidential campaign, and recurrently since he became president, he's just very effective with crowds and getting a filled auditorium, which he handles very well, is important to him personally, but it's an important symbol of success to a larger range of supporters. It gives the impression, and I don't mean the impression is necessarily totally wrong, it gives the impression of a larger wave of support than the actual crowd size, even in some of the filled auditoriums, would warrant.
Mm-hmm.
So, particular brand of politics, and it's not totally new with him, but he's pushed it to an unusual extent in the American tradition.
Hmm.
For his brand of politics, crowd size and crowd enthusiasm is a really important component. Remember, Tulsa was interesting not only because the crowd wasn't as big as expected, but they didn't get particularly excited. They were bored.
That is true. And I'm starting to think that one of the best ways of ensuring Trump's defeat is that people are bored of him. You know, it's not entertaining anymore. And he's an entertainer. There's a lot of theater in politics. You know, you got to keep the crowd's attention. And he's boring. We've been there and done that. So here we are in the era of COVID-19. a little challenging to do crowds. How do you think the lack of crowds, the quiet, will affect perhaps any perception of public acquiescence? You know, the fact that we're not making big crowds because, you know, we want to be healthy. We prefer to live. How does COVID-19 affect it? Are there new ways that crowds can be perceived and still be effective? It's challenging, I think. I don't know. You got ideas on that?
Yeah, and I think one of the concerns for those of us who are Trump opponents, one of the concerns here is the Democrats, Biden, have obviously been much more careful about staying away from crowds than Trump and Pence have been. And I think there's some legitimate concern that they have not figured out a way to demonstrate popular enthusiasm that would replace the visible crowd. Trump has not figured out how to do crowds yet either, but at least he shows up in public and he does have small groups to address. And I think there has to be a little concern that although that's not his showmanship at its best, it may demonstrate an apparent level of activity and an apparent level of popular response that merely virtual presentations can't replicate. I mean, we're in unknown territory here.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very, very challenging. I mean, how can you have crowds? And what does this do, this COVID-19? How is it affecting? I mean, it affected the economy, obviously, greatly, and how it's affecting the perception of either enthusiasm or acquiescence. It's really a challenge. I think this, I got an interesting observation on Facebook as well. Members of Congress are always running an issue behind. And another quote from Skylar Forster, ultimately, those in positions of power have to be compelled by a broad base of political support to act, as FDR said. Members of Congress are not a particularly brave bunch. Might their perception of crowds help move them along and pick up the pace? And I wonder what can be done now in this COVID era to help move them along. And, you know, on both sides of the aisle, sometimes their bravery is rather lacking. They wait, put their fingers to the wind, you know, and don't do anything. But we got to push them along. And that's, I think, what, you know, participatory democracy is about, is people speaking up, having a voice, having a way to participate here. I wonder how in this COVID age, I mean, people can all wear masks and, you know, most of us seem to be doing that. But what can be done now to help move along our courageous members of Congress and pick up the pace on making the change that we need and demand?
Well,
no easy answer, huh?
Look, the fundamental issue right now is control of the Senate.
Yes.
Yes, politicians are timid.
Yes.
This applies to both parties, but the Democrats have shown a willingness to push a variety of legislative measures, but they lack control of the overall Congress. And we're simply paralyzed. We've been paralyzed since after the second year of the Obama administration. It's very interesting now to look at the efforts being mobilized to support the post office.
Yes.
Where the Democrats, obviously, the Democrats' goals are quite clear. They're trying to mobilize crowds, not massive crowds, but they've grouped people in front of post offices as symbolic gestures of need, because remember, this is not just a deliver the ballot issue.
Right.
It's a deliver checks, et cetera, issue. But there's no particular sign that this can result in action until something happens to change the composition of the Senate. So again, crowds, I think they're very effective in many respects, but on some of these obdurate political issues, they just don't replace the vote.
Well, we have to do both. It's not either or, it's both. Right. And we can do it. And I think it's starting to have some effect on the person that Trump put in charge of the Postal Service. I read today, actually, that he's going to, I think it's DeJoy, maybe? I'm not sure. He's going to wait to implement these cost-saving measures till after the election. To me, that shows that the crowd behavior, that they, believe it or not, they listen to the people. Sometimes they actually listen to people. And it frustrates the heck out of me when people say, oh, nothing can be done. You know, I'm not going to vote for any of them. It doesn't matter. But they do. They can listen. And, you know, it is, much as Trump may hate a democracy, it is still a democracy. People's voices can be heard. It's good to know what has worked and what hasn't worked with regard to crowds. Well, if people are interested in finding out more of what you've written, Peter Stearns, is there some website you can point them to?
Well, I have a website. It's not particularly focused on crowds. My interest, this has not been a tremendous center of my own work, except as a consumer of history. But when I came into the historical profession some time ago, the crowd study was one of the leading topics. Yeah. I think we've let it drop a little bit. I think we now have both the opportunity and the need to begin to pay more attention to a more systematic study of crowd dynamics, including many of the points we've been talking about, but particularly what kind of crowd behavior in democracies, where it can be combined with vote and other mechanisms, what kind of crowd behavior is most effective, what's the role of nonviolence, what kind of combinations are most important at this particular point.
Right. Oh, it'd be nice if we learned from history. We rarely do. Thank you so much. Very interesting stuff, and we'll see how it all works out going into the future. Peter Stearns, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. Thank you. This audio is from the Washington, D.C. protest on June 3rd, 2020.